indetectable gravitational radiation from everywhere in the universe. But this is a project that I worked on with my former thesis advisor, Richard Easter, and also an undergraduate from Yale, Richard Anuata, who helped us out with some of the earlier parts of this project. It's sort of it's a fun topic, and this is the first time I've given a talk on it. We just put the paper out last month, as you can see. And it shouldn't be surprising. I hope that I don't lose anybody with any of my slides, because I think it's physics that we all know. But the goal was to try to come up with something new for physics that we all know. And the hope was that an undergrad could do it, although, as it turns out, it took a slightly larger collaboration in order to actually get the project done. So I'm going to start is to just tell you about primordial black holes, and I'm going to do so very tersely by neither addressing why they're there or how they got there. Then go on to talk about the black hole decay. That's going to be the important part. And then also couple that decay into cosmological evolution. Remind us about Hawking radiation, and that Hawking radiation also applies to gravitons. Introduce the computational methods that I use to solve this problem. And then talk about some of the things that we can do with this physics, mainly how can we constrain some parameters in the early universe. And then a section that I like to call consequences, which to us was actually the surprising part of this work, and I think what really makes it interesting. So all of these things, as I should be somewhat familiar to us, right? The history of primordial black holes and black holes and black hole evaporation goes back to the 70s. The existence of primordial black holes was active with one of your new distinguished research chairs. Also, the Hawking radiation is something that's been known for a while, or been speculated for a while, that black holes can decay by quantum mechanical processes that give them the temperature. The black holes then evaporate, giving off all sorts of different particles. And it was also known, and it is known, of course, that these black holes can decay into gravitons as well as photons and quarks and sort of things. And a couple of papers address this problem that what if you look at the what if you look at gravitons emitted by black holes. This was first done, I guess, in 1991. But the work here was sort of incomplete, because it talked about what could be done by looking at black holes, but didn't actually it didn't couple to the cosmology the way that, as it turns out, is the most interesting. And there's also a different perspective on this. There's a couple of papers here that I guess are a little bit more recent, except not quite as recent as this one. But they give you a different perspective of this problem. This is sort of an incomplete analysis that we'll talk about, that talks about some of the things that I'm going to talk about today. So to start with, and this is the part of the talk that you should find least interesting, I'm not going to tell you how the black holes got there. Okay, so the parameterization that I'm going to use is that at some point after inflation, say, the universe was hot and it was dense, and somehow black holes got formed. I like to think about this as the time right after inflation ends. You can think about it as whatever time in the history of the universe that you want. But the important thing is that we start with a parameter that I'm going to call E init, which is the initial energy scale of the universe. And I'm going to talk about it mostly as being the energy scale that that happened at the end of inflation. Of course, one of my hopes is that I might be able to tie this energy scale later on to the actual energy scale of inflation. But precisely, of course, I'm talking about the energy scale of the universe just after inflation. Okay. So the universe is homogeneous, and so I take a homogeneous body and I try to create black holes in them. And the natural size of a black hole is to have a radius that's just the Hubble distance. Okay? If I know that the energy density of the universe is something like the energy of the universe to the fourth power, well, then I can just use geometry to find out exactly how massive these black holes are going to be when they're created at the beginning of my simulation. Okay? So this is the energy scale of the universe comes into the denominator is squared. And this is the only parameter then that sets the mass of the black holes, so long as I assume that an entire Hubble volume collapses into black hole. Okay. And you can notice that I think as we all know, that if I let the energy scale of the universe get larger, the mass of these black holes actually gets smaller. And so that's the first thing that we want to keep in mind, is that as I lower the energy scale, the primordial black holes actually get a little bit heavier. So I just take the Hubble distance, right? And then I just make it a sphere, and I can approximate the first order that the mass of the black hole is going to be the material inside of a sphere of radius of the Hubble distance.
So you pretty much thinking in terms of a black hole fluid or something like that? There is nothing else other than black hole.
Yeah, no, there will be. So I'll get to that in a second. But this is the natural scale at which the black holes can form. So you would imagine that if you created black holes, they would be of horizon size. In a minute, I'll say, well, what happens if not all of the universe collapses into black holes? But at this point, I'm just trying to estimate what the mass of a typical black hole would be. Maybe it's a factor.
But in a physical scenario, you would expect radiation probably at the end of the inflation era, and some region of radiation is too overdense, and it can collapse into black hole. Right.
Yes. Yeah. But the mass of those collapsed things should be of the order of this number here.
Right.
Yeah.
Shouldn't it be kind of the largest black holes that can be formed, because that's sort of the size of the causally connected region? And
right. Yeah. Yeah. It's somewhat of an upper bound, but it's still, you know, there might be a factor of, you know, 10^-1 in front of it. As it turns out, that factor isn't as important as some of the other factors.
Are you assuming that E initial is say locked to the Hubble or not?
I will put a bound on E initial in a moment, or not maybe in a few moments. But for now, I'm going to keep it just as an open parameter, saying that whatever the energy scale of the universe is at this moment is given by E initial.
And why the black hole mass will decrease if we increase rho? Or
right. So if you the volume, so the volume goes as r cubed, right? And so as rho gets bigger, the Hubble radius gets smaller. And so you get...
So you do log them.
Right, yeah, the way that the power work out, actually, the black holes are small.
Okay.
So if I know the mass of the black hole, then I know the temperature of the black hole. This is the well-known relation. And of course, as the black hole gets less massive, the temperature of the black hole goes up. And this is the whole, as the black hole evaporates, then it gets smaller, it gets hotter, it evaporates faster.
It looks like the Curie and the Schwarzschild black hole, the Minkowski space Schwarzschild black hole relations. Or you are using the same black hole?
I think I'm just using the.
You are studying the fairly large black hole in a distinctive background, and so it's just. So the relations that you write down and also the relations from Minkowski.
Yes, yeah, they're
because he has. He's thinking about black hole as after inflation, but it's not flat either. It's like say some FRW.
It's in an FRW.
Right. It's in an FRW.
Right. So
yeah.
It's an approximation in some sense. It wouldn't be exactly true because you don't have a Minkowski.
That's true. Yeah, it's not exactly true because I don't have
So what's how is this compared to the Hubble scale temperature for black
holes? It's much higher. Yeah, the temperature of the black holes are generally the temperature of the black hole is much higher than the main.
I think initially they're comparable.
They're the size the Hubble, right? So they are Hubble. Hubble size.
They're Hubble size.
And you are neglecting the curvature, right? The curvature is for the curvature scale is for the Hubble scale as well. So I just don't, or maybe you will tell me that that's not important, and there are many more much worse parameters.
Well, I without giving away too much of it, the most important thing that I'm doing is I'm going to couple the decay of these black holes to the cosmology.
There is an approximation that's been done here, which immediately appears to be inconsistent, which is you are treating black hole as being in a black space time, and you are looking at the black hole of the size roughly the curvature scale, which is precisely where you would expect that the curvature effect of the background space time would become important.
Yes, but it only happens over a very short period, and so very quickly the universe is expanding very quickly at this point, right? And so the black holes. The approximation becomes valid after a very short period of time. So whatever inconsistencies you might feel with this equation disappear very quickly through the in our simulation. But I'm good. So this is our temperature. The temperature, of course, determines how quickly if I integrate the Planck distribution, I know how quickly the black holes are going to decay. And that now is going to depend on a second parameter, which I'm just going to call G, which is the number of species that are in thermal equilibrium with the black hole at whatever temperature the black hole.
That's just Stefan Boltzmann law?
Yeah. So it's the number of channels through which the black hole can decay. And in general, this is a temperature-dependent quantity, but the black holes in the region of parameter space that we're interested in become so hot so quickly that we can we can treat this G kind of as a constant.
But Tom, you also gain energy through accretion.
Yes, but we neglect that. Basically, when we look at accretion, the picture gets really complicated. And so we're confident that we can neglect accretion onto the black holes because of if we look at how dense the universe is compared to so if you take the density of the universe and you look at how many particles are coming in on the black hole, that's a negligible amount compared to how much the black hole is radiating it. We did make that comparison early on, and it only gets worse as the black hole gets older. So that it's consistent. Yeah.
Sorry, can I just ask a really naive question? I mean, I thought the very fact that you can think about there is a black hole being formed, that seems to be saying that there is a large accretion in some sense, right? So how could you?
Well, saying that there's a black hole being formed says that there's some Hubble scale perturbation in the density, right? Okay. So whatever mechanism that provides that overdensity collapses into a black hole, and then we'll assume that the ambient radiation, the rest of the universe is homogeneous.
Okay.
So what is the mean distance between black holes?
I leave that as a free parameter for now, and I'll introduce it on this page. So what I'm going to say is now I fixed the mass of the black hole to be these horizon-sized black holes, okay? But I'm going to let the total population of black holes vary by some parameter called beta. Okay. So beta is in general, somewhere between 0 and 1, but it can be something very small, or it could be something very close to 1, depending on where you want to put it. Okay, so I'm going to keep beta as a free parameter in my problem, so that way if I can widely vary how far apart these black holes are to see what happens. And so at this point, I have three parameters. I have the initial energy scale, I have the number of degrees of freedom via which the black hole can decay, and then I have beta. So I have a three-parameter problem, and that three-parameter problem is a closed system. So what I can do is I can look at how is the energy density in the black holes changing as a function of time, and how is the other energy in the universe, the radiation energy, changing, right? And so these two equations are well known to us, and because the density of black holes is changing by the amount that I gave you a few slides ago, right? There's a change in the mass of each black hole. And so there's a term that accounts for the change in the mass of the black holes that's emitted as radiation, and therefore it gets added to the radiation bound. Okay, that along with the first Friedman equation fully determines our system of differential equations that'll determine our cosmological evolution. Okay. And so this is where our work diverges from some of the work of people past. And that we're going to, the most important part of our simulation is how these things depend on time and how they depend on the cosmology. So how the scale factor is changing is going to radically change our result. These things are, they're not pretty, but they're simulatable, and so that's what I do. And this is what they look like. So the top frame on the left is the mass of the black hole. This is just for some generic model. The graph on the lower left is going to be the scale factor, the log of the scale factor. And the graph on the right shows the relative abundance of the two components of the universe that I showed you on the previous slide. Okay. So you can see that the mass starts out pretty constant in the units that I've chosen here. It doesn't dramatically reduce until almost the end of the simulation. There's log t on the bottom. The the scale factor, if you have very, very good eyes, you can see that the slope of the scale factor changes somewhere around this point, which also corresponds to the point at which the radiation density is equal to the density of black holes in singularity. Okay, let me run that again, just because
I
like
exactly in my simulation. You just solve those equations.
I solve those equations, right? And so I can solve them for m of t, I can solve them for a of t, and then I can solve them for rho of radiation in the matter.
So what's beta again?
Beta is the fraction of the total universe that's in black holes. So this is saying, you know, 0.1% of the universe it collapses into primary black holes, and that there are some 10 to the third species at whatever high temperature.
You're assuming that radiation and black holes are always in thermal equilibrium?
No, I'm not. I'm assuming that the black holes are radiating at some temperature T that's different from the ambient temperature of the universe, and that the only process that I'm allowing is for the black holes to decay. So I'm only allowing for radiation, for energy to leave the black holes, turn into radiation in the universe, but not the other way. And sorry.
The universe is much hotter than black holes.
No, the black hole, after the very initial point, the black holes are much hotter than the universe. The black holes, the temperature of the universe goes down, the temperature of black holes go up.
The temperature of black holes is up, okay, so because of the dark.
Right. The mass of the black holes goes down, the temperature goes up.
I would say the temperature of the universe is always much larger than Hubble at late times because of the Planck mass. So the temperature is usually much hotter than Hubble, and I think initially the temperature is actually much larger than. At some point they might become involved with each other,
If we assume that, so the argument that was made before was that the black holes in the universe have the same temperature at the beginning of the simulation. If I don't allow.
That's not true. Not the temperature. That's the disinter temperature.
Okay.
Not the temperature of the universe.
Oh, right. Okay.
The photons have much higher temperature, right? The wavelength of photons is much smaller than that.
Okay. Yeah, if I were to plot the temperature of the universe, though, that you know, that it is lower for the majority of the simulation than the temperature.
Okay,
it seems a bit counterintuitive. Like if the black holes are hot, they should really evaporate fast.
Yes,
but this doesn't look like they are.
Well, this is actually very fast. I mean, so these are this is the log of t in Planck units. So this thing is something I don't tend to know.
Minus 10 log seconds scale,
like that. Yeah. This evaporation happens very quickly for this 10 to the 14 GeV model that I'm showing. All
right. So, okay. If the black hole starts hotter than the background, then they will get hotter and hotter, and then they will go away very fast. If they start colder than the background, they will become colder and colder
if the black holes start off very large, and you have a large ambient temperature, then the black holes will start to accrete, and they'll get bigger, and they'll get colder, and that will slow down their evaporation. I'm neglecting that for two reasons. One is that I'm going to put a bound on the energy of the universe, and so I'm going to not allow for those very large black holes. And the second thing that I do is I just don't allow for the black holes to accrete. So in the simulations that I'm running, even if the black holes were very large and cold, and they were accreting and getting colder and larger, that wouldn't have shown up on here. But that's a region of the parameter space that I'm going to exclude for other ones.
What's determining that minimum in omega rad?
This dip right here?
Yeah.
It's determined basically by beta, the initial fraction of black holes. That's an intuitive question. I'll show you a plot of how that can change when I vary beta. Okay. This, as it turns out, after a couple minutes of thinking about it, using this setup, of course you'd expect at some point the black holes were the dominant constituent of the universe, right? The A scale is A to the minus 3, the radiation scale is A to the minus 4. If I have a sufficient population of black holes, I would expect there to be a period of matter domination. What I wouldn't expect is, and I'll get to this a little bit later, the conditions under which this period of matter domination is assured. So this is the simulation. This is the guts of it, right? That I'm able to calculate all of these things using the cosmological dynamics that I showed you in the previous slide, and because I can calculate all of those things, then now I can start to talk about a prediction. So the simple argument is, and I think we can all agree on this, the black hole will decay into all species whose rest mass is lower than the temperature, and this includes gravity. I can use thermodynamics then to tell what the instantaneous the instantaneous distribution of gravitons is going to be. And it's just given by this formula, right, where I've changed from the physical wave number k to the co-moving wave number k tilde. And the reason why I do that is just because it's easier to track on my simulation. If I'm tracking the co-moving wave number of an emitted graviton will always be the same, whereas the physical wave number will change. Actually, I have a little bit of an error here. This g, I guess, is if I were to give you the number of species, this would be the total number of particles that's emitted. For gravitons, you just set g equal to 2 watts. Given the curve that I showed you on the previous slide, I know what A is, right? A is a function of time. The mass of the black hole is a function of time. And so I can integrate this over co-moving wave. I can integrate over time, keeping the co-moving wave number fixed. And I can come up with what the number density of photons is per co-moving wave number at the end of the simulation. I can change that into an energy density of the gravitons at the end of the simulation. And once I do that, then I can find out what the spectrum of gravitational radiation at the end of the simulation is going to look like. So I integrate this thing alongside with the simulation that I showed you on the previous slide, and that gives me the spectrum of gravitational radiation emitted by these black holes throughout the simulation. So once I know that, then I can transfer that quantity, which is given right here, to the present day quantities in both amplitude and frequency. And these are well known transfer functions. I say they're well known because they appear in my papers, but if they're not well known to you, these are they. And the g's that appear in these equations are the g's that correspond to the temperature of the universe, not the temperature of the black hole. So this g star is the number of degrees of freedom at the end of the simulation of the universe, which we take to be something on the order of 200. And then g naught is the number of degrees of freedom today.
But besides gravitons that are being radiated during the decay of black holes, that way if you wish primordial, background of gravitons, how is that compared?
If you wait one slide, let me show you what this spectrum looks like, and then you'll see how it compares to the primordial.
Because naively, I would simply take whatever this g star and divide the total density in radiation by this g star, that would give me the density in graviton.
Of the ambient
background graviton radiation, it's roughly 10 to the minus 2 the radiation density.
Say it one more time. I maybe didn't understand.
No, I'm just saying that gravitons are massless, so g star is the number of massless particles or light.
Right. Okay,
so you start your energy density. I mean, you start your universe in a radiation dominated, in a thermal equilibrium. So we have to assume that there is at least 10 to the minus 2 times the radiation. Radiation energy density, that's how much energy density is in primordial gravitons. So it's important to me to see whether that will be not only the spectrum, but if you know this number is 10 to the minus 16 compared to the you know what I've seen before.
Okay,
I don't expect it to be observable at all.
Okay, well if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, is that if I look at the radiation soup at the end of the simulation. Right, then 2/200 should be the percentage of the total energy density in gravitational radiation produced by the decay of these black holes. So if I integrate over the entire gravitational wave spectrum at the end of the simulation, I should get something like 1% of the.
Well, it's not what I meant. I meant compare the gravitons you get from black holes to the gravitons that were. Along with primordial.
Okay, then that's an easier question, and I'll show you that in a moment. So, well, I mean, what I'll show you is I'll show you what this predicts, what this signal looks like, and then you can compare that to what you believe the primordial spectrum of gravitational radiation to look like.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
I guess, say, depending on the mass of the black hole, do you have to worry about, say, the monocle problem? I mean, given the fact that the black hole will really radiate all kinds of particles with mass lower than the mass of black hole. So you would worry that there will be, say supermassive particles being emitted.
Yes, well, I mean, that's a hope, right? There's this open parameter G that I have in the temperature of the given the temperature of the black hole, there's some G that corresponds to the total number of species that are lighter than that temperature.
Absolutely.
Right? And so I hope to get some large number for that G out.
Okay.
It would be the prediction, and then that would tell me something about the total number of species.
Right. I'm just saying that there may be some constraint on the code here just by requiring them.
If the particles are particularly heavy and I'll ignore.
Okay.
All right. So this is the plot that I showed you before. This is the same selection of parameters, and on the right hand side is the integrated gravitational wave spectrum. So I'll let you endure. So as the universe evolves, the gravitons are emitted. I know what at that particular time, I know what the current day wavelength is going to be, and so I immediately transfer them. To the present day, and I can see how this spectrum of gravitational radiation is produced as the universe undergoes this process here. And what I end up with is in terms of gravitational wave signature, something that's particularly strong, something like 10 to the minus 8. I also see a frequency that's something like 10 to the 16 hertz. And so one of these things is good news, and one of these things is bad news.
So can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So do you expect there to be more than one black hole per horizon during this integration?
Depends on what beta is, but there surely can be, right? Because the horizon's getting much bigger, particularly early on in the simulation. So
if beta is very small, then you don't expect that. But for large beta, at some point, horizon expands. So yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And then what you expect is that these black holes can merge together, don't you?
I ignore that too. I will mention that though. That's one of the things
but
I ignore.
Estimate that might become important.
I haven't tried yet. No. The trouble. So, as you'll see on the consequences slide, that when two black holes merge, then their lifetime turns out to be 8 times longer than the original parent objects, and that's a huge problem for these simulations because we're going to put constraints on how long we'd like these things to last. Okay. So my peak frequency is somewhere around 10 to the 16 hertz. I like to show this graph when I talk about gravitational wave signatures from the early universe, because of course, if observationalists are sort of only interested to 10 to the couple, and the signal that I'm predicting here again is way off to the right somewhere. Okay. It's actually higher. The preheating signal is somewhere around here, with hand waving arguments that might get it a little bit lower. So this is by and far the highest frequency gravitational wave background that I have predicted thus far, and therefore also the least likely to be detected anytime soon. But it's also the highest in amplitude. So you know, you take what you can get. So detection will take an experimentalist who knows more about detectors than I do. But that doesn't mean that we can't do anything with this information. So the hope is now we have the gravitational wave signature, and maybe its presence, just the existence of this of these gravitational waves, can tell us something, or maybe even the simulations can tell us something about physics. Well, the first thing that I hope to do with any model is try to constrain some parameters, and the first parameter I'm going to look at is the energy scale. And there's a sort of a simple argument that says if I produce primordial black holes, I want them to be gone by something like 100 seconds. After the end of inflation, so that way it doesn't interfere with nucleus synthesis. Okay. And so if I solve the differential equation for the dmdt that I showed you a number of slides ago, I can come up with the total time it takes for the black hole to decay. That of course is just related to the initial energy. If I put this lower bound or put this upper bound on the time scale of the decay, then I can get a lower bound on the initial energy, and that's something like 10 to the 12 GeV. Now, I say that it only depends on the energy scale. You can see that that's not true because there's a g here, but at the end of the day, g goes to the power of the minus, to the minus 1/6. And so it weakly depends on g, but it strongly depends on the energy. I'm sorry. But so there's a weak dependence of this lower limit on g, but for the most part, if I allow g to be somewhere between, you know, 10 to the 2 and 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6, that power of g isn't going to be that important. Okay. So I take this now, 10 to the 12 GeV, as a weak lower bound on the energy scale due to inflation, just in the hope that the primordial black holes completely disappear over this time scale. I can get an upper bound on the energy just from the non-detection of.
Wasn't there
a
beta somewhere in that equation?
No, there isn't, right? Because each black, this is, if I want the black hole to disappear, then the complete evaporation of a single black hole is independent of beta.
Sure, but you say you don't want it to interfere with nuclear science.
Okay, if I have a very, very low beta, then an argument could be made that
that constant just comes from the energy density in gravitational waves, or in relativistic particles. Right?
The beta does, or does?
Non-interference with nuclear synthesis. You want the density of the universe to be what is predicted from the standard model within some accuracy, right?
Right.
And that's for that beta, I think that's just proportional to beta, the energy density that comes out of this parking radiation. So it's not really that the black holes are gone, it's just that the energy density due to black holes plus radiation from black holes is small enough that it doesn't interfere.
Right, yes. Yeah, okay. That's true. But with that comes the fact that I don't want the universe to be matter dominated when nuclear synthesis starts.
Is that the, okay?
Okay. And so I will get a stronger. And so anyway, let me tell you the whole story in a little bit. But if I set this time scale at about 100, I have a lower bound energy. And I think that as the parameters come together, I think that hopefully everybody will be happy once I place all of my bounds on it. But then again. Who's ever happened? Okay. Oh, did I show this? Yeah. Okay. So non-detection of primordial gravitational waves gives us some upper bound of the energy scale at the end of inflation. And so I'll assume that it's somewhere between 10 to the 12 GeV and 10 to the 16 GeV. Now, what happens to the prediction that I made when I allow the energy scale to vary over that? Well, it moves from left to right. This shouldn't be terribly surprising to us, right? The higher the energy scale, the lower the peak frequency of this radiation. Okay. The higher the energy scale, the smaller the black hole, the faster it evaporates, and therefore the more redshift it is going to be doing. And for these, I'm just going to say, I just, this fiducial model, and I'll always revert my other two parameters back to the simulations that I showed you before. Okay, now what is interesting too is that the peak of these, the height of these curves is just approximately constant, okay? And I'll talk about that in a little bit, but because I've kept this beta constant and because I've kept g constant, the height of this gravitational radiation is independent of the energy scale. And that reminds me of the preheating signal, but of course, it's backwards, the lower the, with preheating, the lower the energy level, the more redshifted. With this, the higher the energy scale, the more redshifted. Okay. So that's what happens if I vary the energy scale. Now what happens if I vary g? Well, two things. If I allow g to be bigger, I know that the total energy deposit in gravitational radiation will be smaller. There are more species that the black hole can decay into, and therefore the power in gravitons is going to be less. And so I'd expect a suppression of the peak, and I see that. But also, the more species that I allow the black hole to decay into, the faster the black hole decays. So by changing g, I'm actually affecting the system twice. And one of those effects suppresses the peak, and the other effect will move the peak to the left. So if I as I allow g to change, I change the height of the peak and I change the location of the peak.
How high would g have to be to get to a determined?
How low would it have to be? Well,
how large would g have to be to determined?
Well, you'd want G to be, to get to observable frequencies. Oh, well, let's see. Very high, right? So the shortest observable wavelength corresponds to a frequency of 10 hertz or 100 hertz or something. So let's see, every time it's about 1 to 1, right? If I change this by 2 decades, the speed changes by 2 decades. So what is it, 10 minus 8? 10 to the 8, 18, or something like that. But by that point, the peak will be well below any. As is our life. Okay, so that's what happens if I vary E. So I showed you what happens if I vary E. This is what happens if I vary G. The last thing to do is to vary beta. Okay, and so I have 4 curves here. I have a red curve, a green curve, a blue curve, and a brown curve, and they all have different values of beta. I'll mention what they are on the next slide. Interestingly, you can see that the red curve and the green curve lie exactly on top of each other, and this is something that we didn't see when we varied the other parameters. We only saw a change when we varied them. To put insight into that, let me show you the So I have 4 curves here. The red and the green are exactly on top of each other. They're indistinguishable. And then the blue and the brown start to change. So to put some light on what that means, well, this is beta going from 10 to the minus 3 down to 10 to the minus 14. Okay, so I'm varying beta over a wide range of magnitudes. This is the picture that we saw. This is basically the picture that we saw in our previous simulation.
What are you plotting against that?
Oh, great. Yeah, these are the relative abundance of radiation and black holes as a function of time. Okay. So with the lowest beta, I can see that the universe quickly becomes matter dominated. That period of matter domination lasts a long time. If I lower beta by some 4 orders of magnitude, I delay the time at which the matter domination era begins. It lasts for a shorter period of time. But neither the red curve nor the green curve is distinguishable. So this starts to suggest to us that so long as I have some period of matter domination, then I would expect the amplitude of gravitational radiation not to change. Once I lower beta to a sufficient point that I eliminate that period of matter domination, then I start to see the spectrum of gravitational radiation decay. Okay? So it's not until this point here, some beta is 10 to the minus 11, that there are few enough black holes such that the universe never becomes matter dominated. Okay? I should have shown this earlier. Here are the curves. The red curve and the green curve are exactly on top of each other, then the blue curve and eventually the brown curve. So the depth of this of omega radiation then is determined by the initial fraction of the black hole. So the higher the initial fraction, then the lower the omega radiation will go during the simulation. I can put a bound on this. There's the limit between which we have a period of radiation, the period of matter domination and not is calculatable. And so if beta is something bigger than this fraction, which depends only on the initial energy, then I would expect there to be some period of matter domination over the decay of these black holes.
So can we go back to the last slide?
Yeah.
So this is, I think, the concern that Alex had early on. If there is a period of matter domination, that means that basically energy density of black holes is larger than energy density of matter. So then it's not clear that you have an FRW universe anymore. Because either there is no black hole, there's only one black hole per horizon, and if black holes dominate the density of the universe, then you don't really have an FRW system. You have a Schwarzschild. Or if there's more than one black hole per horizon, they can merge and it's going to be some complicated mess.
Right. So I'm somewhat straddling that fence, right? I'm assuming that there are enough black holes per horizon that I can use the FRW. But either the time scale is short enough or the horizon is large enough such that they don't have time to merge.
Well, the thing is, that as soon as you have more than one black hole per horizon, I think they would merge in the Hubble time.
We should talk about that.
So that's something I think must be the case, but maybe we don't know
that. Yeah, okay, because that actually would be very interesting, because that changes our perception a lot. Because then if you have a period of matter domination, then you would expect it to last a very long time. So the parameter space looks something like this, that I've neglected my low energies and my high energies via the arguments that I made previously. I want it to be at least 10 to the 12, so that way they don't last too long. But I want it to be less than 10 to the 16, because that's what the CCD tells me. Okay. So in this unshaded area up here, beta is sufficiently large such that we can be assured that the universe will undergo a matter domination at some point during the decaying of the black hole. And with it comes the most interesting result, the most interesting, I guess, suggestion that we have, is that once you enter into, if you're in this parameter space and you enter into a period of matter domination, then all of the radiation that exists at the end of the simulation was radiation that was emitted by the black hole, particularly towards the end of its lifetime. And so once you enter in here, you've extinguished any information you know about the universe before these black holes existed, i.e. all of the information about inflation. Okay. So I could add to this list, as we all know. The main things that I've neglected, or that I thought that I neglected, was I neglected the gray body calculations, gravitons are spin 2, they're suppressed by a factor of 10 to the 2 or so, or 10 to 10 to the 2 when they're being hot irradiated, and so you would expect that there could be a suppression of the peak by some order of magnitude. because G varies so wildly in the different simulations that I have, I didn't bother with this factor of 10. But to be complete, you'd want to put the gray body correction in. Another big question is mergers. If there's sufficient, if the black hole undergoes matter domination and there's a sufficient period of time, you'd expect for black holes to merge with each other. When the black holes merge, they last about 8 times longer than their parent black holes, obviously extending the period of matter domination. And then an interesting thing that was remarked upon when I first started was that we'd like to add some mass distribution of these primordial black holes. Right now, I'm assuming that they're all of the same mass, but in truth, some might be a little bit smaller. And by putting in some distribution of masses, we might learn a little bit about, we can see what that does to the dynamics of the universe. So the consequences of this, a population of inflationary scale primordial black holes could produce a detectable gravitational wave signature if any one of these proposals that occasionally get posted on the archive are true, and very high frequency gravitational wave signature are detectable by tabletop experiments, then maybe we'll see something like this one day. But that detection might put a bound on the inflationary energy scale. If I can see the peak, then I know what it gives me some energy scale at the beginning of the simulation, i.e. the energy scale at the end of inflation. But also the dependence of the number of species at the temperature of the black hole is something that's particularly interesting, because detection of this signal might tell us something about the total number of heavy particles. The downsides are, of course, that the matter-dominated phase could diminish the primordial perturbation spectrum, which is something that we should also keep in mind just when we're talking about viewing perturbations in the universe, that if under very generic situations, black holes can be created and the universe enters an early matter-dominated phase, then we might not be looking at perturbations. We might not be looking at the perturbations that we think we're looking at.
Is that true?
If you have some spectrum of perturbations that's created, that's present in the radiation bath at the end of inflation, those get completely diminished as the black holes evaporate, and with it the information pre-inflationary universe.
Why is that?
Because if we go through a matter-dominated phase, the initial radiation, all of the original contents of the universe are drastically reduced, and so they just get deleted. Like 50 minutes, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
Yeah. What about the bar detectors? Aren't they sensitive to higher frequencies than the detectors that you listed?
The bar detectors?
Aren't there any bar detectors?
Oh, well, so they're not on my clock because they aren't working, right? So there are these proposals, and I assume that these are one of them, to have these arrays of nanoscale detectors that are sensitive to gravitational radiation at high frequencies. But to my knowledge, they're not particularly successful at this point. But
yeah,
if that's not true, I'd love to know.
The change in length has to be measured so sensitively that it's like the distance scale of a nucleus or smaller for one of these giant bars, and they haven't been able to overcome that problem.
Okay.
I mean, I guess the idea is you put thousands of them on some device. But to my knowledge, those technologies are not successful enough yet at the moment.
Have you thought about the classical symmetry? I mean, you're talking about, I mean, unless your initial perturbation is exactly spherical symmetric, that was sound kind of fine tuning or mergers, you could expect a fairly large classical decay, which would be presumably much more frequency than you could see.
Yes. Yep.
From mergers,
There's the merger signature. I mean,
mergers are any symmetry on all these big massive.
Right, yeah. And we neglected that just because one could put some sort of bound on what the amplitude of those. Well, actually, so if the black hole's created, if the universe undergoes a matter domination towards the end of the lifetime of the black hole, and the gravitational radiation from its asymmetric creation is at the beginning, then that information might also be wiped out. But that's a that's something that we probably should talk about in length at some point. But it would be interesting to see if that's a survivable signal, and if it is, then how does it compare to the quantum mechanical signal? But of course, the merger signal would be very strong if it happened at any time.
There is also this hard question that you've been involved in as well. The preheating itself is a very homogeneous process, basically at the end of inflation. So that would emit gravitational waves as well. And I suspect that there probably would be a continuous spectrum between, maybe. So this merger signal, merger would be somehow similar to this preheating gravitation.
But the preheating signal is gone if we have a matter dominated phase. The preheating signal is pre to this, so the preheating signal would be gone. And depending on when the merger happened, if it happened early on, then you'd expect that to get diminished. But if it happened towards the end of the lifetime, then, which you more expect it to happen towards the end because that's when the universe is at.
So the part that's very suspicious that you're saying that you get rid of the primordial perturbations from inflation, because so on superhorizon scales you expect these Hilbert perturbations to stay constant, and so at some point you might convert all your black holes to radiation, but that shouldn't change this consideration.
Oh, that's true. I'm talking about not at smaller scales, so with the scales comparable to the horizon of the universe.
Okay, but the observable scales would be much larger.
Yes, I guess that's true.
Okay, so good. Okay, good. If there are no more questions, then let's thank Tom again.